Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 35, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. A principal changed her approach to discipline after she met a student she once expelled. One Texas school district closed for a week, but not because of the weather, and South Carolina is about to lose thousands of experienced teachers. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education, plus we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week we talk with a teacher that has flipped reading upside down in her classroom. Hey everybody, Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined with teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, what's going on with you?
Not too much, man. Just trying to get some work done.
Someone's got a birthday coming up this weekend, I think. Am I right?
It's not me and it's not Lissa. I do have a birthday coming up. I did not expect you to bring that up on the podcast.
We won't say your age or anything, but hope you have a good time. Hope you have a good birthday weekend.
Let's just say I'm struggling with this age more than I've struggled with other age. I'm turning 36. I don't mind people knowing that, but 35 was okay. 30 was great. 35 was okay. 36, though. Something about that number.
There's just nothing about that number is, I think, the issue.
Yeah, there's nothing remarkable about it whatsoever.
What do you think, Lissa?
I don't know. It just makes me a little sad.
I feel like I'm scaring the hell out of 40, so I'm like rolling my eyes at 36. I'm like, what? Yeah,
Russ is the youngest of the three of us, so but we're all pretty close. Yeah. So we're all kind of like, birthday, let's not do
so
anything.
Much.
Yeah, but we were in Vegas for your 30th, so that was a good one.
Yeah, that was the best one I've had thus far.
All right, so Lissa, why don't you get us into the teacher's lounge? What do you know?
Well, the other day I had something pop up on my feed from the Teach for America conference. It's a speech given by Chief of Elementary Schools in Madison, Wisconsin. Nancy Hanks gave a speech about the school-to-prison pipeline.
It's all in love, and I don't have all the answers. I've just tried to learn from my mistakes.
Which if you're not familiar with that, which I feel like anybody in education is familiar with that, it's, you know, just the alarming rate and consistency between children that are expelled and the likelihood that they'll end up in juvie or some form of prison later in life.
It's a devastating event, I guess, for these students.
Absolutely. And there's a correlation for sure that's undeniable in lots of data. And so she was kind of speaking what I found really important is she was speaking to teachers and administrators, and she was trying to kindly point out their role in the pipeline, because, you know, we all hear about the pipeline and but it seems very foreign. It seems very like we don't have anything to do with that. We didn't start that, and that's there, and it's unfortunate, but we can't really play a role. And she's really kind of calling them out and calling herself out in the speech.
Just this past Christmas Eve, I ran into one of the only students that I ever referred to for an expulsion when I was a principal on the west side of Chicago. I was on an elevator headed to Denham, scrolling through my Instagram timeline. The bell rang, the door is open, and I heard a raspy, warm voice say, "Hello, Miss Hanks." My eyes lifted from the screen, and I saw this tall and familiar frame standing before me. I remember the incident quite clearly. He brought a BB gun to school, a very realistic-looking BB gun. And I was livid at the time.
So there was this, like, awkward moment. Like,
right. Well, so she says, yeah, like, his face seemed familiar, and then she immediately realized this is the child that I expelled.
I wasn't angry because I thought he wanted to hurt somebody. I actually didn't believe that he did. I was angry because I had busted my behind for 2 years at that point to turn that school around and establish community and to repair the climate and to make kids feel safe. Him bringing that BB gun wasn't just a threat to safety, it was a threat to me and my reputation that I was building for myself and for the school, and nobody was going to compromise that.
He kind of represented in her life, in her professional career, and as part of the community and school, somebody that was doing the direct opposite of everything she was trying to push for.
I'm sure it was bad PR for her. You know, right. Child brings gun to school.
Right. So, she, of course, there's this zero tolerance. And so she was like, you know what? I have to start the paperwork for this expulsion.
At the time, I couldn't separate the child from the act. I couldn't find that powerful just mercy that Brian Stevenson so passionately writes about.
And so he was expelled.
I greeted him with the, "Hey, sweetie, how are you?" It was all I could manage to get out at the time. My heart was pounding, and at that moment, I could feel the full weight of my decision rushing at me all at once. Is he still in school? Has he been in trouble with the law? Did I toss this child into the pipeline? My mind was racing, and at the time, I felt like I couldn't breathe.
He responds that he's been, you know, doing well, and he's still continuing his education.
I'm cool, he replied. You know, I'm at Phoenix, the military academy. My grades, I mean, they're pretty good. I'm getting ready to take the ACT. I was actually going to come out and see if I can get some help with that. I was selfishly relieved that despite my lack of compassion and understanding and patience and mercy, that he seemed to be thriving. And that by the grace of God, he hadn't wound up in the juvenile justice system. We chatted for a few minutes. I fished a business card out of my bag. I gave him a hug, and I told him to call me so I could make sure that he was well prepared for the ACT. Okay, cool. Merry Christmas, Miss Hanks, were his parting words, and we both went our separate ways. I cried as soon as I got in the car and all the way to dinner. I prayed for forgiveness for that time and any other time that I betrayed the privilege given to me to be a steward and protector over children I serve.
Then so she's trying to tell everybody that, you know, we are all people and these kids are all people. And her experience kind of made her change from a zero tolerance policy.
So today I'm grateful. I'm grateful for the grace that someone extended that young man when I couldn't muster it up myself. I'm grateful that I got a chance to get it right in my current role as the chief of schools in Madison, Wisconsin. In 2014, under the leadership of my superintendent, we passed a new policy that departed significantly from the district's past code of conduct, which was based on zero tolerance. It was a courageous and conscious choice that included the elimination of suspension in grades pre-K through third grade and a drastic reduction, thank you, and the number of infractions that could lead to suspension and expulsion in grades 4 through 12.
I do think even people in education, I know teachers that don't even know what happens after someone is expelled. And, you know, sometimes I think people think, oh, it's just high schoolers that are expelled. Oh, absolutely not. Nope. First, second graders, you know, and there are laws now in some states that actually make it forbidden to expel in the younger grades. But there are so many states that have no form of schooling for these children once they have been expelled. There are some.
It's like homeschooling or.
Right. There's some states that have alternative schools, and they also have counseling and things involved with that. But there's lots of states, like to name two, Louisiana and Michigan, that have nothing for the children. Once they are expelled, there's no schooling of any type unless they do something on their own, seek it out on their own.
What I really loved about this, when you listen to it, is this lady's giving her testimony of this like moment where she, you know, was embarrassed and in this awkward situation, but it turned out okay, and she's thankful in hindsight. She's giving this testimony in front of this massive audience that, according to the Washington Post, isn't an intimate setting at all.
Mm-hmm.
But according to the paper, there were like people wiping tears from mm-hmm. their face after hearing what she had to say.
Right. Well, and I think a lot of that is because I think any teacher and any administrator can picture a child in their mind immediately that they may have had. Maybe they didn't get expelled, but maybe they look back years later and think, oh, I was a little too harsh on that one. Or, you know, that parent conference, you know, if I had that parent conference again today, I would do it completely differently. And I know I have some that come to mind. And so I think anybody can relate to it to just say, whoa, slow it down.
I think that the truth of the matter is that, you know, students who are expelled are damned. You just need to understand that whenever we expel kids, even at a young age, we affect that child for the rest of their life. And some kids are able to overcome that and some kids aren't able to overcome that. But the reason that expulsion is so, I guess, difficult of a choice is because if you look at the statistics, children of color are incredibly at a disadvantage when it comes to expulsion, meaning that they're more likely to be expelled over students who frankly are white or non or even affluent. So if you look at the statistics, which I really hadn't even considered that preschool expulsion is a thing, which is nuts. But every school district in the country knows about Office of Civil Rights data. And a lot of districts that are under consent decrees from the Justice Department, meaning segregation era or DSEG orders from U.S. Department of Education, have to submit Office of Civil Rights data. And that data is collected, and I think it's more broadly collected than just those who are under OCR consent, but the data is pretty staggering. So Black children represent 18% of preschool enrollment, but 48% of preschool children receiving one out-of-school suspension. So at the end of the day, what you're looking at is that if you're a Black student, you are three times more likely than a white student to be suspended in the United States, which is bananas, right? At the end of the day, whenever you look at it, it's not just students of color. It's girls of color. It's students who have English language learners, students with disabilities. And those students are also more likely to be arrested. You talk about restraint, which is when a student is physically restrained, immobilized, or are confined. Students of color are also more likely to have that happen to them as well. In fact, the statistics also prove that you can largely predict your prison population in your state by disciplinary infractions and third grade reading scores. You can go back and look at the percentage of students who aren't reading on grade level by grade three, and you can largely predict how many students are going to go to prison.
Wow.
Suspending students, students dropping out, they don't just disappear to the ether, right? They go to prison, or they're more likely to commit a crime.
Well, I loved your testimony. It really made me think. Go ahead, Russ.
It made me emotional. Like, you could see that she genuinely felt very bad about that. And you guys should go, the folks listening should go and watch the video. OCR compliance is a nightmare, right? It eats up somebody's summer. It eats up weeks out of their summer trying to collect all these statistics. But the reason they do that is to show these numbers to folks so that we can reform the way that we discipline children.
That's good. Mm-hmm. You know, it's late January 2017, or no, it's late January 2018. And,
are you still writing 17 in your checks, Nick?
I just might be. Hopefully people are still cashing in, though. Flu is rampant throughout the country right now. And from what I understand, Russ, some school districts are taking some pretty drastic measures.
Well, they are. And I think there's a school district in Texas, Bonham ISD, which is just, if you look at a map, it's a little bit northeast of Fort Worth, Dallas area. They have canceled school through this Tuesday. Yeah, the past week through yesterday for the flu. So, and they're going to take cleaning crews are going to come in, and they are going to completely disinfect classrooms and buses. So they're going to come in with bleach and bleach that whole place. This year in the United States, the flu vaccine, which typically protects us at a pretty good rate, is only about 10% effective to prevent you from getting the flu. And that's a key differentiator. I heard people the other day talking about, well, it's only 10% effective, I'm not going to go get it. Well, that's only to prevent you from getting it, but it can still lessen your symptoms if you do get the flu vaccine. You can still get it. The flu season is not over. But they sent out a notice on the 16th that just said, after much consideration, essentially we're going to have to cancel school, not just for students, but for teachers as well. Basically take the time to, they're trying to limit exposure to other students, and which is the right thing to do. Whenever you have an outbreak in a school or a district, it's really the most responsible thing to do, because a lot of folks don't understand the flu is deadly. The flu kills a large number of people every year, but it specifically is really bad for children who are young or older folks as well. In fact, tragically, from my hometown, a 2-year-old just died of the flu, just recently, perfectly healthy child.
Right. And who actually had been to the doctor. It wasn't like they avoided treatment as well. So
absolutely. And I think probably she had some sort of underlying pathology, I would imagine. Unfortunately, the truth is your child is more likely to die of the flu than to die on their way to school. And yet every child has a car seat, but not every child has a flu vaccine.
This really is one of those failures of the media, I think, as well. We don't cover flu deaths and the significant or potential impact that the flu can have. We put a lot of panic in the media about other topics. But, you know, roll back to 1918. There were more Americans killed by the flu in 1918 than died.
Spanish flu.
Yeah. Than died in World War I, World War II, Vietnam, and Korea combined. Like, that is staggering. And how many times have you heard about the flu of 1918? I would argue 80, 90% of the public never has even, like, learned about that in history.
I taught it's last pretty... year.
There you go. Of course you did. Teacher extraordinaire.
Yeah, teacher extraordinaire, but the tape between her glasses. So that's
but so. I didn't get the flu vaccine this year, so I mean,
you know, I didn't get it either, and my daughter got the flu, and I'll tell you, whenever we had a trip that was scheduled, and the doctor was like, "Well, you know, I'm sorry about your trip," and I told her, I was like, "I'm not immediately concerned about our trip. I'm concerned about my daughter having something that is deadly." And so we kind of talked through that, and she took Tamiflu and never really was terribly symptomatic, but certainly tested positive for the flu. So, you know, congrats to Bonham ISD. I think that you made, well, not congrats, I guess, but good call,
yeah,
Bonham ISD for canceling, because it's a hard decision to do it, because they're going to have to make up that time, but it could very well have saved the lives of some students. So you just can't, you know, you have to kind of temper the anger of missing a spring break versus the lives of students. And I think that they made the right call here.
Switching gears, story out of Greenville, South Carolina. There was actually a program for teachers. It was called the Terry Retention Program, and it's coming to an end. The program allowed retired teachers to return to the classroom and earn their usual salary while also earning a pension that was placed in an escrow account. And some state lawmakers were like, well, this is double dipping. But it was apparently very effective at helping with the teacher shortage.
Absolutely.
Greenville County Schools, just one county alone, is about to lose 283 teachers and administrators. And statewide, it's estimated that 3,400 are about to leave with the end of this program. So my question I pose to you two is this program a good thing and should continue? Or was it just a Band-Aid fix and they need to find a different strategy?
Okay. I'm gonna answer first, Russ.
Okay.
I think when you have that much of a teacher shortage, then I think if you're talking about a wound in a Band-Aid, if you have an open wound in real life, the first thing to do is to apply pressure and to stop the bleeding. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think this is an excellent solution. Yes, it may only be temporary, but if you turn and do nothing, then you're still hemorrhaging. So I feel like this is a good thing. If there are people that are willing to do it, absolutely. And you know, we can all benefit from wiser teachers also, and they can benefit from younger teachers. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good, healthy mix anyway. It's not going to solve the problem, but it's definitely going to help stop the bleeding than just having long-term substitutes that have no experience with children at all. And, you know, so that's what I think.
Russ?
I think that it is the same net cost. So whether somebody is... if somebody's receiving a pension, they're going to be receiving the pension either way, and then you're paying someone for that position. So to the state, it's the same net cost. And there may be some additional costs because of the step years, like the experience years somebody may have.
Right.
Their salary may be greater than a new teacher. But assuming you could find a teacher who had 20 years experience, you'd be paying them the same thing, and you'd be paying that other person their pension. So I don't really understand, you know, what the difference is. I think that they have a problem with it because they're, quote, double dipping, right? And if it's solving your teacher shortage, what real difference does it make? The unintended consequence could be that teachers retire early and start double dipping. But in most states, they just cross state border. So like I have a friend of mine who's a superintendent who is one of the best superintendents I've ever seen. He's fantastic, but he's retiring. And he's going to go take a job in another state because he can't, you know, he will make more money, and he's a relatively younger guy. And so he can make more money just, you know, working in another state and starting a new career. We need him in our state. It's important that we have him in our state. But because of the way that we set, you know, pensions up, we're gonna have to replace him. And so it's silly because effectively you're still paying both sides of the VIG either way, right? So as a legislator, what do you really care? Like if the money, the net cost is the same, other than you besmirching somebody for making more money than you do, what difference does it make to you?
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. That's a good point in terms of cost. And you're right, the step does kind of have to be factored into there, and it probably does cost a little bit more. But it seems like a war they just need to fight on two fronts. They need to fix teacher recruitment while they're using this as the Band-Aid fix.
Right, and they need to fight it on with everything they've got. They need to do recruitment, like you said, but they also need to fix teacher pay. They also need to get certified quality teachers in the classroom in the meantime. I mean, they need to, from the top legislature, they need to change state funding. I mean, it's going to only get worse.
40% of new teachers quit within a year, and a third of all teachers quit within their first 5 years. Mm. And that's tough. We've got to stop drumming good teachers out of this profession.
Right. Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is actually a teacher that Lissa knows, and she's a fantastic one.
She is. This is great.
She's got a really interesting outlook on teaching reading to students, and it's unique. I think a lot of teachers should consider it.
Awesome. Let's hear it.
All right. Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment says she's completely changed the way she teaches reading by switching from a whole class novel study to allowing each individual student read whatever inspires them. Lisa Ainsworth teaches elementary students at Benedict Day School, and she's the first guest we've ever had to record in the studio with us. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
You have a pretty interesting story to tell because you've kind of evolved the way you've taught reading. You used to teach more in a public school, mm-hmm. inner city school, and when you moved to private school, that all changed, right?
It did. It changed in a couple ways. First of all, I was put in first grade. I had only taught third and fourth, so that was a huge change. If you've ever never taught phonics, I akin it to teaching Latin. I mean, it's like a foreign language. So I had no idea what I was doing. I had to really change the way that I taught those kids, but I had to fall back on what I knew. So I started with AR, which is, I'm not bashing the program, but it didn't work for my students. Some of them saw it as a competition and only read to earn stickers, and then some didn't care if they ever took a test and never wanted to read anything. Mm-hmm. But I had to have some way to say that I was doing the right job or on the right track. Well, in public school, you have that end of the year state test. Well, I didn't have that anymore. So what did I have to look at to say, okay, check this off my list, I taught this and they accomplished it. And I had nothing in first grade. And so I ended the year thinking, what progress have I made with these kids?
And so you were like, I've got to find a different way.
Yes. So then I found out that I would be going back to third grade the next year, mm-hmm. which I was very relieved. But I knew I had to do something different because then I realized that I had made really good test takers, but I didn't really have kids that had fallen in love with reading the way I did. And so I just started looking. I was open to any ideas, and I actually found someone through Instagram. She popped up in my feed, and her classroom looked intriguing. It looked very cozy, and the kids were all reading different books. So through her, I found Donna Lynn Miller, who wrote Reading in the Wild and The Book Whisperer. And her books changed my life. I think I read both of them cover to cover twice that one summer and like wrote all over them in sticky notes. And so Donna Lynn's idea was basically that why do we limit kids based on a reading level on an assigned standardized test? You know, why not let them read what they're interested in and then take that level and teach each child through that? So you can teach one skill with 16 different novels. It doesn't have to all be on the same novel.
And that made sense to you because you talk about how you enjoyed reading mm-hmm. just at a public library.
Right.
Where you get to pick out your own book.
Right. My brother was tutored in math, probably starting in elementary school. So I spent, several afternoons a week in the library. And my mom never cared what I read as long as I was reading. And so I wasn't, what would be considered an above-level reader at that age. But she never said, this is the third grade level, you have to stay here. She said,
which is what accelerated reader is.
Right. It says, and it goes even more specific. It'll say you are middle third grade to middle fourth grade, so you cannot read anything above or below that.
Right.
And my mom said, here's your library card.
Read what you want.
Read what you want.
But that's got to be frightening for, say, a listener, a teacher, who's mm-hmm. thinking, Are you crazy? I'm going to let 30 students read what they're... How am I going to...
It's terrifying.
I feel that. And I should say I've actually seen Lisa's classroom, which this is an exciting interview because I have popped in and out of her classroom. And I have to say, usually when I'm shutting the door saying, excuse me, and shutting the door, I'm thinking, how is she doing that? Like, how is she doing that? I don't know how you do it.
It is. It's scary. And it's also, I mean, I won't lie, it's a lot of work because you go from taking this little cute packaged, you know, font, novel, study, whatever, that everybody does the same thing at the same pace, to looking at, okay, my skill is going to be teaching point of view. How am I going to get that across to, in my classroom, thankfully, 16 kids, not 30, but how am I going to get that across to 16 kids who are reading 16 different books on 16 levels? And so I do that through read-alouds. I read aloud to them. Sometimes it's a chapter book. Sometimes it's a picture book. I even teach fifth grade, and they love being read aloud to. There's never an age where I can't pull out a picture book, and they're just excited.
37, maybe?
We'll have to see.
I would like that. Yeah.
But they get something different out of it at every age. You know, obviously, the older they get, the more deeper the meaning they understand from it. So I can model that for them with the books that I read aloud, but then on their time... And every single day, no matter what's going on, whether it's a short day or a long day, we always have independent reading time. I turn on the music and we do nothing but read. And my one requirement is that you read something. I won't tell you what to read or force you to read anything, but you just have to pick something. It may be the same, you know, Captain Underpants book you've read five times. If you want to read it a sixth time, great.
This kind of led to you changing your entire classroom layout, didn't it?
It absolutely did. It was this one group. They're my experimental group, and I actually teach them now fifth grade writing. So I guess the idea behind it was to have a community of readers where we're all sort of invested in this together. You know, we have these books that we've read together that we discuss together. And so that led to a lot more collaborative projects and group writing and group projects. Well, the desk kept getting in the way, so I rearranged my room 100 times. Well, then... For Christmas one year, my husband got me this really cute Adirondack porch swing. Well, I had a bench on my front porch that I didn't have room for, so I thought, I'll bring it to my classroom. So I set the bench in there with two little pillows and thought, it's just cute. Well, the kids kept going to the bench, and they would fit as many as they possibly could on the bench to do their work and not at the table, at their desk. And so I thought, well, what's the difference, really? Like, what does it matter if they're at the bench or at a table?
Right.
So slowly but surely, I started adding more home furniture and accessories to my classroom and taking out the school furniture. And now my classroom is, I'm going to do flexible seating. So I have no tables, no desk, nothing.
I have to say Lisa's classroom, it is so homey. Like it really is. You walk in there and you just feel at ease immediately. And was it hard? Like, okay, so I know you teach language arts. So when you don't have surfaces and, you know, sanctioned areas for serious stuff. Like, was it, how did you deal with that as far as if you're taking an assessment that's more standard, I guess?
The only time that it's come, that we've had an issue with it is when we do our ACT Aspire testing at the end of the year, and we've just gone to the library where they have big space to spread out. But any other time, like classroom test, they literally sit wherever they want. Like, you may come in and we're doing a vocabulary test, and there's kids laying on the floor with clipboards, or turned upside down on a cushion, sitting at my desk.
That's great.
Standing against a bookshelf. I have a lot of standing spaces. I've noticed that they tend to gravitate towards that, so they can stand and write and then move. And you just don't feel quite
why,
so...
Like, when you say stand and write, like they're prop, like leaning over a table?
Yeah, like a counter height table.
Gotcha. They like that, mm-hmm, huh? Mm-hmm. You think just burning energy?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, think about it. How often do you sit in the same exact position for hours at a time and focus?
I get up and walk around all
the
time.
Yeah. So why do we not let kids do that?
Right.
And they really do it in Lisa's class.
Yeah, they never stop moving.
I have to say, I just think you're so inspiring, which I know that you took a lot from other people that
absolutely
with books and things, and that's awesome. But I really did see, I worked at the same school that Lisa works at currently, and I saw her first year, and then I saw everything change. Like, I really did see other outside concepts and ideas make a difference and change a teacher's whole way of doing things. And it,
right.
I mean, it was like you just came alive. I mean, really.
Yeah.
And
great.
The students came alive.
That's
I mean,
great.
They really, And so let's talk more about the furniture.
Yes.
And like, so if somebody, I think there will be a lot of somebodies out there that think, okay, I want to do that. I want to bring some stuff in. Like, did you ask for donations from parents? Did they have things that they would give you? Did you, like, I mean, that must have been expensive in some way.
I mean, it can be. Actually, I started with my house. I brought the little blue bench, and then it turned into a baker's rack, which I still have. I have all of my, you appreciate, all of my art supplies on the baker's rack. So, and they have little caddies and cubbies and places. Everything has a place to put it. But I just started adding things that I found at garage sales and vintage sales. And somebody would say, hey, I have this table. Does anybody want it? Absolutely. I'll take it.
Yeah.
And it started with that. After the first year, I did have parents that want to put more input when they realized that their kids would come home and say, like you said, it's comfortable and it's cozy and I feel like, you know, I'm at my living room.
You'll definitely have to send us a few photos so we can
yes.
put them with the show notes and maybe even use it for the picture for the show. But let me ask you this. If you were to have to go to public school next year, could you duplicate this? Would you duplicate this? In, back
absolutely.
In the and would it be harder or do you see it, you've got it figured out and you feel like anybody can apply this anywhere?
I think anybody could do it. I mean, as long as your admin understands and, you know, I have the research to show why this works better, but really it's common sense. And that's kind of what you have to point out is that, you know, like I said, we don't want to sit for 2 or 3 hours in one seat. So this is what works best for kids. But it can be done on any budget. I absolutely believe that with any amount of space, because coming from a public school, the classrooms that I've taught at a private school are half the size. So I'm working with a lot less square footage and still able to fit what feels like different areas of my room. I have a library in my classroom mm-hmm. that I've slowly built. I have the standing table. I have a large picnic table, a coffee table where kids actually sit on cushions on the floor, an enormous rug. So I'm able to build those spaces with different furniture, but I love that it's also flexible. I might notice that kids are avoiding a certain area, so I rearrange it one day. And when they come in and see that it's different, then they want to sit in the different spot.
Hmm.
Do you feel like you could still teach to the, I don't want to say teach to the test, but like, you know, measure the same way in a public school, the restraints that a public school will give you sometimes in terms of measurement? You feel like you could apply this curriculum that way?
That's a hard question. Because I definitely don't teach to a test.
Right.
I'm sure that you could. It would probably be a little bit more restricting with what you're able to do as far as, like, I could choose any book that I wanted to read aloud and kind of pace my own skills that I teach.
So it's that reading aloud that's really key, though.
It is.
Yeah.
To the absolutely.
Gotcha.
So you're saying if you were trying to make sure that they understand, like, I know when I taught self-contained in the public school setting, there were benchmarks that we had to note that mm-hmm. we had taught them, mm-hmm. we had retaught them, and they were mastered or not mastered
mm-hmm.
per child. So I think that's what Nick is asking is, are you able to do that? And so you're saying if you read aloud,
yes, absolutely.
And you take a skill, you know that's when I targeted that skill, that's when
yes.
I taught it, introduced it, reintroduced.
Okay, so for example, talking about when I said point of view, I have a picture book that's called You Would Not Want a Unicorn for a Pet. Mm-hmm. And it's really cute, and the book talks to the audience in second-person point of view about how you would not want a unicorn, and unicorns are messy, and you have to clean up after them. Well, it's unusual that we find books in second-person point of view. It's more likely to find them in first or third. So I would read that book out loud and ask the kids, what kind of difference do you notice in what the author is saying and who they're speaking to? And so then I might ask them, okay, go find another example of a second-person point of view book in our classroom library. And then maybe have them write dialogue from that book and say, what specific thing points this out as second person point of view versus first or third person based on what I've modeled for them. But then they're using the resources that we have, but they're not all using the same book.
Very cool.
I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
So, okay. So now I do recall, since I was down the
yes.
hall, I do recall you had to have a meeting with parents at the beginning of the year kind of to launch this whole crazy idea. Tell us about
is
that.
Is this every year or just when you made the switch?
Just the first year.
Okay.
I think it's kind of become well known now that I do things really different. And that was because they were used to when you got to second grade was the year that everybody read the same novel for the same unit. And so the parents would get an email that said, please purchase, you know,
right.
whatever novel and have it for next Monday. Every child have it. So I had to let them know from the beginning that they didn't need to do that. And I knew that I would have a lot of questions. And I thought the best way to do that is just to, I came up with a PowerPoint with all of my research and my inspirations and met with the parents and said, I want to create a community of readers here so that your children leave understanding that a book is not just a chapter test. A book is not just a book report and a project. A book is an option that you have of exploring what you're interested in and taking that as far as you want to. And whether that be reading something challenging or reading something interesting or rereading the same thing over and over. And so they actually were really receptive to that.
How many years have you been doing this?
This will be my third year.
Have you ever had a student come back to you and talk about getting that inspiration to read?
Absolutely. I actually have a student that is in fifth grade now. So she was in my experimental group. She had a lot of health issues in third grade, and her mom wrote a blog post the year after she finished up some clinical trials, and she mentioned that I had made a huge impact in her daughter's life of just opening her eyes to reading for pleasure.
That's really cool. That's got to be the most rewarding thing, right?
It is.
Okay, so I do remember one time, Lisa, coming into your classroom, and it was, like, completely dark, and you had, like, curtains drawn over the door, and I didn't know what was going on. What is that? No lockdown or anything.
Yeah,
huh? No. What was going on there?
That was what we called Flashlight Friday. Again, it was another idea that I saw on Instagram. I know Twitter is a great resource, but it moves way too fast for me, and I like the pictures on Instagram. So... basically, that you just turn the lights off. Now, I took it a little bit farther and got blackout curtains for my windows and bought little $1 flashlights at Walmart. And every Friday when we would read, I would turn all the lights off and give the kids a flashlight and turn on our music and we'd read in the dark. And it was amazing how quick they would get settled into this little cubby of being in your own space. And you could really see how all the distractions that as minimal as they can be, that still take your attention off the book when you have nothing but you and a flashlight. It's like that camping out feeling.
Yeah, magical
they
moment.
Loved it.
That
yes.
is cool.
So if somebody wanted to start this in their classroom, like I know that you said you had attended some workshops and read some books, you know, mm-hmm. are you going to be able to give us some links or things that would help
absolutely.
Somebody get started?
Yeah, I can give you some links for the reading workshop method for Donalyn Miller, who is definitely the first place to start for flexible seating and some great workshops. I had the privilege of going to Nerd Camp two summers ago, mm-hmm. And it was awesome. Got to see Kate DiCamillo for the first time. We all wept like little girls at a Beaver concert. She's so inspirational. But it was an amazing 2 days of teachers who were passionate about what they were doing, wanting to share ideas with each other.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, Lisa Ainsworth, we really appreciate you taking the time to share this, and hopefully there's some teachers out there who will take this idea and run with it. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
Oh, boy. Here we go.
All right. First question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Well, of course, reading.
That makes sense, right? What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Since I do so much group work, I would have to say we need to teach our kids how to work with somebody that they disagree with. They get to a point where they can't agree, and then they just freeze, and they don't know what to do. And that's a real-world skill that they need to know. You may not disagree with somebody, but you still have to work through that and keep going.
That's a good one. That's the first time we've heard that one. What does every child deserve?
A teacher who is passionate about what she does.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Since I've started teaching, and now this is my 14th year, there's always been this pressure to deal with the hot topics that are going on right now. Like in the beginning, it was No Child Left Behind, and then it was standardized testing, and then Common Core. And now I think the hot topic is STEM. And I don't think we ever look past that. We don't look to what could be the future challenges that we need to anticipate and the future jobs that our kids are going to have. We're so focused on playing catch up with what's trending right now.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Encouragement. I actually had a parent send me just a really sweet email last week saying, I really appreciate something you did in class. Thanks so much.
Which teacher changed your life?
Oh, that's a hard one. Since I'm an elementary teacher, I'm going to say my second grade teacher, because I was a painfully shy kid in elementary school, and she was the first one that made a personal connection with me where I realized she's actually a real person, not this, you know, mythical being that only lives inside the classroom.
Right. I remember watching when you ever see a teacher on Jeopardy and you're like, oh, they're going to get all the questions right because they're a teacher.
Yeah.
Little,
exactly. You know, like, and then they don't. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Or like when a kid
they knew all the answers.
When a kid sees you in the grocery store and looks at you like, oh, my gosh,
yeah,
she's real.
Of, yeah, you're out of food. Your box.
Yeah.
Last question, pen or pencil?
Colored pens, always.
Colored pens. That's colored a first pens. For us. Again, Lisa Answorth, we really appreciate you taking the time for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and subscribe to the show, and we'd also love it if you leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!